What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
With more than 500 programs a year, there is never a dull moment at the Commonwealth Club. If you're a fan of this podcast and you like hearing new and provocative discussions with the most interesting people in the world, consider showing your support by joining the Commonwealth Club and ensuring that the conversations never end. Visit commonwealthclub.org/special to get special rates on membership.
Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good morning. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club, a virtual program of the Commonwealth Club. I'm Celia Menchel, chair of the club's member-led Middle East Forum, one of many member-led forums at the Commonwealth Club doing a variety of programming. Now it's my pleasure to turn the program over to our distinguished moderator for today, Jonathan Curiel, journalist and author.
Thank you, Celia. And again, another welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Jonathan Curiel, a San Francisco-based writer who's reported widely about the Middle East, and I'll be your moderator for today's program called Progress Toward Middle East Peace. A reminder to you to please put questions for the Q&A that we'll have later in the program into the chat. And now it's my distinguished, that's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Fadi El-Salamin. Fadi is a prominent activist and also a political commentator. He's also a known critic of the Palestinian National Authority, President Mahmoud Abbas, and of Hamas, which governs Gaza. Recently, for his because of his pro-democracy work and his anti-corruption work, Fadi has received death threats from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which is the military wing of Fatah. He's born in the West Bank, and he's a senior adjunct fellow at the Bipartisan American Security Project. He's also a businessman with experience in the Middle East, Africa, and the United States. He's also a graduate of the Seeds of Peace, which is a development organization, leadership development organization. And he's a graduate of the Johns Hopkins Advanced School of International Studies. Fadi El-Salamin, welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you. I'll just start briefly by bringing everybody up to date on where the Palestinian issue is today. And the most recent issue that everyone is tackling right now is the issue of the legitimacy of the Palestinian Authority and holding democratic elections, both parliamentary and presidential, due to the pressure exerted on the Palestinian Authority by the Trump administration and the Trump peace plan. That political pressure was in the form of peace agreements signed with neighboring Arab countries or unneighboring Arab countries, the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, along and the cutting of the aid for the Palestinian Authority, the closure of the PLO or the Palestinians' representative office in Washington, D.C. These were all seen as enough pressure for the current Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, who's been in office for the past 16 years since the last elections, decided to move closer into unity conversations with Hamas, and then call for parliamentary and presidential elections, one, to signal to the rest of the world that he is now renewing his legitimacy, but also to signal to the Palestinians that in the midst of all these failures, there is hope at the end of, and there's light at the end of the tunnel. Fast forward to today's events, the Palestinian president is projected to delay or cancel the elections and maintain his undemocratic hold onto power, thus creating the possibility of further violence or further outcry against not holding elections. Now, within the banner of holding and not holding elections, there are many, within that headline, there are many subtitles. Some have to do with the Palestinian Authority's intention to blame the Israelis for not holding the elections, meaning using the issue of Jerusalem as a main issue in order to create a pretext for the authority to say to the Palestinian public, because of Israel's refusal to hold elections in Jerusalem, we're unable to carry out with those elections. There are many other issues which are have to do with splits within Fatah. Fatah, the current ruling party, has about two or three different, it has split basically into three different factions that are running, or splits that are running in the parliamentary elections. So all in all, we have a very weak, corrupt, divided Palestinian political front right now, especially under the Palestinian Authority and Fatah. There's a division between Fatah and Hamas. And so this creates the main issue for why we don't have elections and why we don't have a what would be perceived both by Israel, the United States, and the international community as a strong or legitimate leadership to negotiate with or engage with in a peace negotiations. But this is just one of the main obstacles. There are others. There is a very right-wing Israeli government that does not see any value currently in negotiating with the Palestinians. They believe from what we see in terms of activities on the ground that basically, claiming the land and taking the land is a God-given mandate, and basically no need to negotiate with a weak party like the Palestinians, and comes under that many many issues that Israel today is facing, both domestically and internationally, criticism that has to do with human rights abuses, and obviously the need to end an occupation and the need to end the control over another population's life. The other main issue that I see as serves as an impediment for not moving forward with a serious peace conversation between the Palestinians and the Israelis is so far the lack of interest in the current U.S. administration. Lack of interest meaning not willing to commit too much political capital between the Palestinians and the Israelis and then face failure like other administrations before it. So if you notice the current Biden administration, what they're doing is, in my view, is the bare minimum, which is resumption of aid, signaling to the Palestinians that they will recognize a two-state solution, but not doing much beyond that in terms of pressuring the two parties to come together or get into any sort of peace negotiations at this stage. So that's, in summary, the three different reasons, issues that I see in the face of any real progress towards a peace between the Palestinians and Israelis today. I'll stop here and hopefully take questions or open it up for discussion so that we can cover the other issues that I didn't allude to. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Fadi. Let's start with this question. I mentioned that you've received death threats. And if you could talk about, as best you can, what those threats were, and in a way, how this is emblematic of a breakdown in the political process in the Palestinian territories in Palestine, and also maybe what it says about relations with Israel. You've been called, as other people have been called in your position, a tool of the Israeli government, blah, blah, blah. And so, again, if you could speak to the threats that you've received and what it means, not, of course, to you personally, but also what it says about the political process.
Just to give some people some background on my work. So for the past 10 years, I've been focusing on exposing corruption within the Palestinian Authority and human rights abuses. I've been doing this as a Palestinian, as someone who believes that we deserve better governance. And as someone who, living at the time in the United States, could afford to do this far away from the reach of the Palestinian Authority, far away from the reach of an authoritarian figure like Mahmoud Abbas. Last month, basically, I came to visit my family and the Palestinian territories. I came to visit Hebron, and after my visit, the next day, basically, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade issued an explicit death threat because of my anti-corruption work and my pro-democracy work. The death threat obviously was taken very seriously by me, by the United States, by the State Department, but was not in any way condemned or dealt with by the Palestinian Authority. They've done the classical move, which is, oh, we had no idea, we didn't know about it, which is, knowing what I know, or what, you know, most serious people who deal with this part of the world know, there's no way a threat like this would be issued without the Palestinian Authority knowing about it, without Fatah knowing about it, especially considering the party that issued it. What does this mean? What it means is you have a Palestinian president who's been in power for the past 16 years, refuses in any way to crack down on corruption, refuses to share power, refuses to allow for a democratic process to take place. Not a fan of elections, not a fan of being told this is wrong or this is right. Basically, it's his way or the highway. I'm not the only person that he's dealt with in this manner. Prior to my death threat, one of the Fatah Central Committee members, a guy by the name of Nasser al-Qudwa, who is now heading the Barghouti list in the parliamentary elections, was expelled from Fatah Central Committee, was threatened, and I have it on very good authority from individuals who were in the meeting with Mahmoud Abbas that Mahmoud Abbas told Nasser al-Qudwa point blank, if you run in this election against me, I will shoot you. So he made death threats very explicitly to other people face to face. Maybe in my case, it was a little harder since I'm a US citizen. And so he needed to use the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade to make that threat clear. So we have a very serious issue. If we're going to join the fast-moving train in the region, which is creating alliances around security, around economy, and so on, we need a new leadership. We need a new leadership also in the Palestinian arena to address the many crises that are facing the Palestinians, poverty, unemployment, human rights issues, anti-corruption and corruption. So for all sorts of reasons, we really need elections, and we need the international community to push for these elections to happen.
Well, and you're referencing the elections that are supposed to take place, both parliamentary and presidential. As you say, Mahmoud Abbas has been in power since 2005, so 16 years really without the last election. In the last election, Hamas was vying for power, and that's what led to the very deep political split between Hamas and Fatah. Hamas is now in control of Gaza, of course, but there's a lot of enmity between Hamas and Mahmoud Abbas and Fatah. This election, in a sense, you know, Mahmoud Abbas called for elections, you know, on as Biden assumed the U.S. presidency. Do you think that was a miscalculation? And if so, why? I mean, why would Mahmoud Abbas cling to power when he knows that there are lots of Palestinian factions who would like to replace him and who see him, if not as corrupt, as borderline incompetent in terms of running the territories?
I believe you're correct. It was it was political maneuvering on his part. It was a miscalculation. I don't think he believed that Hamas would agree to the elections, and therefore he would always have a pretext that this is a leader who's been in power for 15 years, but is trying to hold elections, but is unable because of the political division and because of Hamas's refusal. What turned out to be a surprise for him and everybody else, that Hamas agreed, even though I personally believe that they're not really very happy about the current elections, and they themselves do not want elections, but they don't want to be viewed as the reason why there is no elections. So the elections would be a danger to both Hamas and Abbas. Hamas suffered for the past 16 years a loss in credibility, a loss in popularity among Palestinians because of their governance and their governance style for the past years in Gaza. So they're not as popular as they were in previous elections, and they know this. And yet they do have certain technical advantages. They are united in a list. They have one voice. They have one one list that they presented for parliamentary elections. And therefore, anyone who would vote against Fatah would end up likely voting for their list, and that might help them. The fact that they're not divided, the fact that they still have some unity among them as a movement, works to their advantage. That is not to say that they are liked or more popular. In fact, if Fatah, and that's a big if, did not have these splits, did not have Abbas wanting to hug and hold power for himself, and there was a united Fatah front, I think they would do much better than Hamas, especially in Gaza, where people have tried and rejected Hamas's rule for the past 16 years.
So you grew up in the West Bank, and at the time you were growing up, it was Yasser Arafat who was the major figure in Palestinian politics. And a lot of people saw in Arafat, they saw a lot of things. They saw idealism. Some people saw terrorism. Some people, when he was alive, they did describe him as well as being corrupt. I would like to ask you about your personal, in a sense, your personal journey, as it were, your political journey. Growing up, you know, did you have the idealism that Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian National Authority, that they could, you know, steward in a Palestinian state, a bona fide Palestinian state, with as much territory as possible pre-1967, and that was a possibility? And then somehow, as you became politically aware, and as you went to Johns Hopkins and elsewhere, you know, your idealism maybe waned. What caused you, in a sense, to do the anti-corruption work you're doing now, where you're very public, you're receiving death threats, and you are one of the people who is seen as a kind of major critic of Abbas?
You know, I grew up in the West Bank until I was about 14, 15 years old. And at the time, I don't think I was fully aware of the different political fast moving tracks within Palestinian society. The image of Arafat at the time was that of positive, was that of a unifying leader who was working towards a Palestinian state, towards improving Palestinian society. I became aware and was able to meet Arafat because of the Seeds of Peace program, where we would sit down with Israelis and discuss the political reality. He would be meeting with Rabin, with Shimon Peres, with Bill Clinton at the time. So the atmosphere was that of hope, peace, and there was a future to look forward to. Then, obviously, Second Intifada happened, and things slowly began to kind of sink in, and reality hit. And obviously, that's not what happened. For me, the transformational change became when I lived in the United States and I became exposed to the idea of having a democracy, having checks and balances, having accountability for politicians, making sure that they don't have absolute power, that at the end of the day, their ultimate job is to represent the public and be accountable and for the public. And that's, I believe, is the foundation for my belief system, for my anti-corruption work, for my pro-democracy work. My background, I came from a poor family. I'm the oldest of 9 children. And growing up, I assumed that all Palestinians were the same. We were equal in misery, as we say. I've come to find out that that is not the case. There are very, very corrupt Palestinian politicians that take advantage of Palestinians, that take advantage of the Palestinian issue, the Palestinian cause, and they are an impediment to a bright future for Palestinians, both in the West Bank and Gaza, and elsewhere. And so I've decided that and these are people that I met, I engaged in conversations, and when I would compare myself to my friends that I grew up with in Hebron, some were either imprisoned or killed. Some are unemployed to this day, are unable to secure jobs, either within the Palestinian economy or outside. And that's where you really reach a crossroad. You have to make a decision. Do you just accept this and move forward, or do you put up a fight against it and try to change that reality and then bring bring back some sort of contribution to the place where you came from, and try to rebuild things the right way. And I believe that's what I'm doing.
So going back to the early 2000s, 20 years ago, I was a reporter then for the San Francisco Chronicle, and I remember interviewing then Prime Minister Ehud Barak. And at the time, what was being floated was this idea that in return for a return to pre-67 borders, that a lot of Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, Egypt and elsewhere, that they would recognize Israel in a much more formal way than they had done. And so this was the carrot that was being dangled then in return for a comprehensive two-state solution. Israel would give up these territories in return for Arab recognition. Arab recognition has happened, especially under the Trump administration, the Abraham Accords. We have the UAE recognizing and formalizing relations with Israel. We have other Arab countries on the brink of doing that, possibly even Saudi Arabia. That's been a huge change for Palestinians, because that was one of their, aces in the hole. Can you talk about that and how, in a sense, the Palestinian advantage, as it were, in that regard has changed considerably in the last several years?
Yes. What you're referring to is the Arab Peace Initiative, which is peace with the Arab and Muslim world in return for peace with the Palestinians and creating a peace, a Palestinian state that lives in peace side by side with the state of Israel. That obviously no longer is on the table. I believe the recent agreements between Israel and some of the Arab countries, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and others, it reflects the current reality more than anything else. There is a serious, deep security alliance between Israel and those countries, facing external threats, Iran being chief among those threats, others, Islamic fundamentalism, terrorism, regardless of how they define it or identify it. On top of this, there is an economic alliance that is growing, and I personally see the division within the Palestinian leadership. I also see the incompetence within the Palestinian leadership as a contributing factor to this reality that the Palestinians have to deal with. They didn't know how to deal with Trump. They didn't know how to approach Trump. But also they relied heavily on what they call our Arab depth, our strategic Arab depth. These are Arab countries that are on the brink of war with Iran. They face an existential threat, and they see a serious value in engaging with Israel. They've tried to engage with this current Palestinian leader, but he, before there was normalization or Abraham Accords between some of these countries and Israel, there were no relationships between, for example, the United Arab Emirates and the Palestinian Authority. I believe that's an issue that Abbas should own. It's entirely his doing. And so he in this didn't just happen overnight. This was the basically, you know, this was the culmination of several works. One of them was Abbas's damaging the Arab-Palestinian relationships. The Arabs also seeing very little hope in terms of any progress with this current leadership. And so they moved on. And that's an issue that, you know, initially Abbas was able to export this crisis and say, you know, oh, we feel we were stabbed in the back. We feel this was a betrayal. But feelings are a thing. And then reality is entirely something different. As a leader, what will you do for your people who have been now sidelined and marginalized, and largely because of your work? He doesn't have a good answer, and so and it's, on top of that, does not want to hold elections. And so this is a very very sticky issue. I do hope that once we have elections, we'll have a better leadership that is able to handle this issue in a smarter and more creative way than has been done.
Thank you for that. I want to remind our audience that we're talking with Fadi El-Salamin, and this is a program called Progress Toward Middle East Peace. We are taking questions from people online in the audience, and one question relates, actually, I think it relates to what you went through. You talk about Seeds of Peace, which, as you've mentioned, is a leadership development organization. This question is, how should community leaders promote cross-culture connectivity? I'm extrapolating and saying that means, how can Palestinians and Israelis get along? What are the political ways, or personal ways, cultural ways, that Palestinians and Israelis can better understand each other? If you could talk about that idea about cross-cultural connectivity.
Look, Palestinians and Israelis are there are deep links, right? They are there, but they need to be obviously cultivated. The political environment prohibits this. It's a fascinating issue because if activities are happening where Palestinians and Israelis are engaging in dialogue or promoting cross-cultural events, you'll find that those who are attacking them or trying to prevent them are the Palestinian Authority, so that they can keep a monopoly on this issue. Nothing should happen or should be allowed to happen without their involvement and their role. And so they don't allow it. It's not easy. That being said, it's not easy in the current political environment because it's often used as political it's often used as fuel for political arguments and political discourse. It's not an issue that there's an agreement on where people could say, yes, this is important, we should support it, let people to people connections grow in these times. So it's an important, it's a very good question, but unless we do have a fundamental change in the current leadership, a change that signals hope for the Palestinian people, is going to be very difficult.
Yeah, I just want to say, a follow-up to that question. I've seen film, Israeli-made film, talking about the definitive connections between Palestinians and Israelis. And there was, of course, this TV series called Arab Labor, which came out, I want to say, about 10 years ago, which was a comedy in a sense, but really well received in Israel, not only among Arabs, but also, Jews in Israel. That's a cultural, to me, like a cultural, signifier of what could possibly be. Can you talk about, pushback from your work among Palestinians, if there is, who are not, say, extremists, who are not part of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade? Do you get pushback from Palestinians who say Palestinians should focus more on Israeli policies, entrenched Israeli policies, settlements and so forth, that have also pushed Mahmoud Abbas into a corner? I guess the argument could be like, why aren't you focusing more as much on that as you are on your anti-corruption work?
So let me just give you an overview of the past 10 years. When we first started talking about corruption within the Palestinian Authority, the initial reaction was, Fadi, this is normal. Of course, a minister should have a car, a company, a palace, a fancy car, right? What do you want them to do? Ride in the same bus as everybody else? This is a minister. Then over 3-4 years later, you'd see that slowly others are joining in the conversation, and the perception and the mindset towards corruption is not that of this is normal. And fast forward to today, I'm probably the least person that criticizes or talks about corruption compared to everybody else. Over 80% of Palestinian youth believe that there is serious corruption within the Palestinian Authority, and it needs to be addressed. The pushback is no longer about why. Initially, there was a pushback, but today, no, quite the contrary. In fact, the only people who are pushing back against me are Abbas and those around him and his circle, because they've seen the effects of my work on theirs and on their, obviously on them and on the public's perception of them. Now, their failures are seen not just on the political file, not just in the financial file, but let's talk about Corona, for example. You're talking about corruption in distribution of vaccines. The arrival of vaccines, 200 or 500 shots, were taken immediately. And instead of being distributed to those who needed most, it went to the president and his first circle. And if the mindset was not so aware, was not so ready to look for signs of corruption, to ask questions, we would not have had this issue. So the sensitivity to corruption has become so high that the Palestinians now question everybody, everything. They ask questions about every budget item, every project that's announced. And that's a healthy society. That is the norm. That's what should happen. Yet, in order to transform this mindset, in order to transform this this reality into practice, we need elections. We need to have those who are asking questions in parliament, those who are asking questions in the anti-corruption commission, and are able to try and hold people accountable. But they've been blocked so far because of the monopoly on power by Abbas. So to answer your question, today, no. In fact, the contrary. When I run into people, either they want to they're happy to meet me, or they want to take a picture, or they're really excited about what we've been doing. And Jonathan, it's a very serious, deep network of individuals, very dedicated individuals inside the Palestinian institutions that really care about exposing the corruption and want it to end, and they want to crack down on it.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
So this is not something that is not welcomed by the public. Quite the contrary. It's very welcomed by the Palestinian public. Now, why don't we talk about the Israeli occupation as a? We do talk about it, but it's not the priority. Almost every organization here and there makes that their main focus, their main priority. But I've chose this issue, this area, because I believe this is where I could make a change. This is where I could make some progress in Palestinian lives. And that's why I've focused on it.
Well, you are in your 30s, I believe. And in the United States, there's a lot of focus on the next generation of leaders who have been elected to Congress, a lot of people of color, women. And so we mentioned that Mahmoud Abbas is 85. There are other Palestinian leaders who are vying, politically speaking, who are well known within Palestinian society, maybe not as known here in the United States, but certainly well known within Palestine. I'm wondering if you have been asked by anyone to join any political circles, if you, for example, have even asked to run, to consider a future political run, maybe not now, but maybe, you know, a decade from now.
The political atmosphere right now, it's not the same as the United States, where they see a potential and then others will try to invest in that potential and harness it. Here, it's very crowded. They see a potential that's seen as a potential threat, and it's all efforts are garnered to push it away. For me, I have been approached to run in parliamentary lists. I have been approached to run in other elections, but I just don't believe right now that Abbas is actually going to allow for Palestinian elections. And until I see a serious commitment to holding the elections, until I see guarantees from the international community to actually push forward and make sure that the next generation of Palestinian leaders, like you said, emerged both men and women. Palestinian women are incredible, and they should be allowed to have a much bigger, more serious role in Palestinian politics. But unfortunately, I don't see that happening under the current leadership. So unless there's a serious push towards this, we're really stuck with the same old, and frankly, it is creating a fatigue effect in locally, internationally, and that's why you see, the most countries are willing to do are maybe give aid to a certain extent, just keep this issue in the background and away, because they don't see any serious solutions or any creative ideas coming from new blood or fresh blood. None of this is being presented to serious players to engage, and it's creating a serious rift between the Palestinians and the rest of the world.
You mentioned the pandemic earlier, and we have a question from the audience about whether the pandemic can provide transparency into how the Palestinian National Authority is accountable to the public. You talked about these vaccines that have gone to higher ups rather than a more general population that might be in greater need. What is the transparency around that? What are people learning and knowing about vaccines and the vaccination program there in Palestine?
So it's a very serious issue, and in fact, it's a great case study to take a look at, because it does expose the Palestinian Authority on many fronts. For example, when the first dosage of vaccines arrived, the vaccines were distributed for the Palestinian leader, his circle, and in fact, their relatives in Jordan were able to get that vaccine shipped to them before others with critical need were able to get it in the West Bank and Gaza. That's one. Two, to this day, not everybody's getting the vaccine. Three, I think that this was a story that was covered widely in the national press. The Palestinian prime minister went on public TV and said, we have vaccinated 100,000 Palestinians who are crossing into Israel. At which point, the first visceral reaction came from the Palestinian public that said, you really are lying to us in a very blatant way. We were vaccinated by Israeli medical workers at the checkpoints. This had nothing to do with the Palestinian Authority. And so you're talking about deceiving the public, misusing funds, misusing resources, complete disregard for those who are less fortunate, for the poor, for disadvantaged, and complete, you know, acting with immunity. You don't, if you know that there will be consequences to an issue that is so known, so public, like the issue of who's administering the vaccination, you won't come forward as a Fatah Central Committee member, as a prime minister, and make those allegations and then face no back, you know, face no consequences whatsoever, regardless of the backlash from the public. And so it's really fascinating to me. But yes, it's reminiscent of the pandemic corruption. It's the deep corruption within the Palestinian Authority.
You are in your 30s. There are Palestinians. Let me just say that there's a great Palestinian diaspora. There's a Palestinian diaspora that you can find in Lebanon. I remember reporting from Lebanon about 20 years ago. Going to refugee camps that have been there since the 1940s. You've had generations of Palestinians grow up, and so you have grandchildren of refugees who are still in these camps, still makeshift camps in Lebanon and elsewhere. So I'm wondering, you know, the Palestinian diaspora, which is, you know, let's just say it's, you know, easily millions of people around the world. What is your experience with them? And do in a sense, do you have a connection to other generations who are urging you to do your work? Or is there among older Palestinians a certain, you know, as you say, you know, threshold that they reach? Well, you know, there's no progress at all possible.
No, I think the diaspora or the Palestinian diaspora has always been very important for the Palestinian issue. They've been the backbone, the engine for support for those living on the inside. I have a very good relationship with the diaspora, especially the community in the United States, and recently developed also great relationships with the Palestinian communities across Europe and in the Middle East. There's a split between those who are obviously opposed to the Palestinian Authority and those who believe that the priority should remain towards the larger Palestinian issue, which is the Israeli occupation and trying to get through that first, then worry about, you know, about local issues like corruption and elections and democracy within, you know. But it's a debate that exists among the diaspora. I think it's a healthy debate, but it doesn't, you know, my experience, I could sit with a Palestinian American in the United States and have this debate, have this conversation, and it's normal because we're both exposed to, you know, what a democracy is. The issue is you're not even allowed to discuss or have this conversation inside the Palestinian territories. If you so much as make a Facebook post criticizing the government, you will be arrested the next day. You will be put in jail for 15 or sometimes 30 days by the Palestinian Authority for so much as criticizing the president. For example, taking an extravagant trip on a $50 million private jet to country X with his grandchildren or with his family members. If you so much as mention this, you will be arrested for 15, 30 days with no charge. And it could be even more. So it's not, you know, the diaspora, I feel, I understand and I feel the pain and the split and the priorities, but, you know, it's not the same. You can have a civilized, wonderful conversation with members of the diaspora versus you're not even allowed to have a conversation or question the legitimacy of the authority on the inside.
You know, some of the words that come to mind when I think about the situation in Palestine is tragedy. You know, again, we talked about the hope that a lot of people had for a two-state solution. We could talk about the hope that people had when Mahmoud Abbas ascended to political power. Can you talk about the why behind Mahmoud Abbas, about why he became so entrenched and why he would not hold election for 15 years? Is this a kind of odd metamorphosis of Mahmoud Abbas? Or in a sense, looking back, is this something that one could see in his leanings before he, you know, took over, politically speaking, for Yasser Arafat?
It's a very good question. I actually was one of those hopeful people when he took power that now we could have democratic institutions. We will have elections every 4 years. We've moved away from the traditional Palestinian leader, which was the, you know, the figure, the leader, meaning Arafat, to now the, institutional type of leader where elections would be held every 4 years and so on. What I believe we missed or overlooked was Abbas's, Abbas grew up in Syria, grew up afterwards and lived in Russia. He had his PhD there. I really think he's heavily influenced by that type of leadership. And down the road, when he had the chance, he eliminated the parliament. Basically, now he rules by decree, meaning almost like a king. In fact, exactly like a king, not almost like a king. He rules by decree. So whatever he decides is law becomes law the next day, and does not like or accept any type of challenge to his leadership. So was he always like this? I believe yes, but he knew that he couldn't exert that type of style of leadership and still get to where he is today. So he played this, nice grandfather. You know, he has a famous line when he says it, most people say, oh, what an amazing man. And then once they come to realize what it means, it is a tragedy. So he says this, and he's been saying this since 2005. I will not run for another presidential term. I am only here for one term and that's it. Later on, we've come to believe that what that means is there will be no presidential elections as long as I'm alive. And that is the reality. So he's very clever, very creative with the way with his messaging. But deep down is a very authoritative, he's a dictator with really... with an iron fist, brutal towards those who criticize him or question his style of leadership. And so I'm not surprised that he's not happy with elections, doesn't want elections. He shut down the parliament, but also shut down the judicial system. It's unbelievable. Basically put a judicial system that supports his presidential decrees. And so you've got a president who's the judge, the parliament, the executive, the legislative, and so on. And only two other people that come to mind when I think of this are, Vladimir Putin and Bashar al-Assad. And these are people that Abbas was very close to.
Yeah, and those names sent a chill in me, frankly. We have about 5-10 minutes left. There are lots of questions to ask. One of them is, Mahmoud Abbas is 85. His health, it's probably, to use an expression, comme ci, comme ça. Are people, though, in a sense, preparing for his departure, even though he may today announce, halt to elections? But are there, in a sense, as far as you know, moves being made to, in a sense, prepare for Mahmoud Abbas's eventual departure, whether it's, you know, next year, 5 years from now? Is there, in a sense, a kind of, you know, underground political, movement happening that we don't know about, we don't hear about?
There is. And it's, in fact, here's my worry. If we don't have elections, I believe that the Palestinians are heading towards violence to change the political system. And that's the danger, because the violence could overspill. It could be redirected towards Israel. It could be redirected towards others. And so, you know, more than two-thirds of Palestinians, according to recent polls, want Abbas to leave, want him to step down. So there's no dispute that people want him out and they don't want him to stay in power. The question is, how will he be replaced? If it's democratic, free and fair elections, then obviously we have a clear path towards transition in power. If it is not, and that is what Abbas is trying to do, to prevent that path from taking place, then what I see, what I hear, will lead to violence. You have members of the Fatah Central Committee acquiring weapons. You have others, obviously armed groups and factions in the West Bank, who will basically try to take matters into their own hands and see how they could settle this this score without elections. So it's a very slippery slope, very dangerous alternative, and I think the cost will be very high. And so, again, I cannot underscore how important it is for the international community, for those who have influence, to allow for democratic Palestinian elections to take place.
We have an election that may be canceled today, maybe tomorrow. From what I'm reading, and you've talked about this as well, the pretext, as it were, may be that Palestinians in East Jerusalem may not be able to vote in the election, and so Mahmoud Abbas has sent an overture to Israel to allow that to happen. Israel has, for now, maybe ignore is the wrong word, but ignored it. East Jerusalem, of course, is a main issue, a huge issue. Before 1967, it was part of Palestine, and now it's occupied by Israel. How significant and important is East Jerusalem in this context, in the political context, and also in the context of violence, potential violence, as you're referencing?
Look, Jerusalem obviously is very important for the Palestinians. It's important for the Palestinian cause. The symbolism, you know, there's no way to describe it aside from it's extremely, extremely important. Yet, what is being done today in terms of political theater by Mahmoud Abbas and his political operatives is to create this image that no elections could ever happen without holding elections in Jerusalem. No elections, you know, they've gone yesterday, one of the central members committee made this statement, no elections could ever happen as long as there is an Israeli occupation. And so basically the idea and the theme that they're pushing out, no elections, regardless of what the pretext is. But here they're trying to give us two good reasons from their standpoint, which is one, Jerusalem, two, the occupation. And that's what I don't buy. That's what I don't think that my belief is the Palestinian public is not buying, not accepting. They want elections because there's an eagerness, there's a deep, overwhelming majority that wants to change this political system, push out Abbas and those around him for all types of reasons: political failure, corruption, abuse of human rights, cracking down on all forms of dissent, limiting freedoms, and so on. But using Jerusalem as a pretext is not even believed or accepted by the Palestinian public, let alone the international community. There are ways around it. You know, I understand the political importance of holding elections in Jerusalem, but there have been actually options that were offered. One of them was you could have the ballot boxes at international consulates that are willing to hold the ballot boxes. You could have ballot boxes at the post office that will accept people's votes. So there are many creative options, but the Palestinian Authority has been saying no. And it's obvious why. The elections will mean the end of the political life for Abbas and his entire system, and they will have to face consequences. And again, they don't want to do that. They're trying to stay in power as long as they can.
Let's go to what may be the last question for you. It's from an audience member. The question is, Palestinians have prospered and provided leadership and contributed to global institutions. When will this be allowed to translate in Palestine? And, that's a good question for you to answer because of your life and studies in the United States. And right now you're in the West Bank. But if you could talk about that, perhaps as the last question for you.
It's a great question. You know, President Bill Clinton will often say to his Palestinian friends, every Palestinian friend of mine is either a professor or a millionaire. And I believe there's a certain truth into this. You know, the Palestinians are obviously a bright, incredible people. They've done amazingly well when the environment allows for them to do well. And that's an amazing and a sad question at the same time, because obviously the first place where we should be doing amazingly well is Palestine, is the Palestinian homeland. But again, it's almost similar to the Lebanese diaspora. If you notice, many amazing, incredible Lebanese are doing amazingly well all over the world, except in Lebanon. And so the political environment is really suffocating for those with thriving potential, those with incredible ideas. And it's not just politics, it's not just business, science. And it's because the system does not allow for competent people to thrive or rise through the ranks. It's a corrupt system that will hire based on relationships, based on not based on merits, but more, nepotism and so on. So unless we change that system and create the perfect environment where if you're a talented Palestinian man or woman, you're able to thrive, you're able to rise through the ranks, you're able to be in the right place and able to contribute to society positively, unless that happens, we will have what we're having today, where you could thrive in other systems that allow you, right, a democracy in the United States or Europe, but not at home.
So let me, in the few seconds we have left, I know you're in the West Bank. I mean, how long will you be there, and when, what's your situation there right now?
My situation is still very dangerous. I I'm trying to keep a very low profile. I'm not, saying exactly in which town I'm staying. But I am hopeful that, the pressure will continue to mount on Abbas and others to condemn the death threat. I could have easily, obviously, flown back to the United States. The State Department offered to do that. But I think I'm known to put up a fight regardless of the consequences. And I don't want to give Abbas an easy win. I'm staying here as long as I need to stay.
Well, Fadi El Salamin, we want to thank you so much for your time here at the Commonwealth Club. We want to thank our audiences as well for tuning in, and also those who may be listening to this on the podcast and later on. I've been Jonathan Curiel, and it's been my pleasure. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, which is celebrating over 116 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.